When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Hi, everybody. Welcome to Who Cares About the Rock Hall, a podcast about the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. I'm your host, Joe Quazala. I know entirely too much about the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. It is my burden. It is my curse. And yet it is why this show exists. With me, as always, is the skeptic, the voice of the people, the little devil upon my shoulder, Kristen Studdard. Hey, Kristen.
Hello, Joe. It's me.
How you feeling?
I'm feeling okay. I'm ready for today's episode. I'm excited about it. So yeah, I'm doing good. I'm in my kitchen for a change. You'll Wow. notice if you look at the picture.
Yeah, a colorful background you've got there. But, you know, this is we're deep in nomination season. The ballot is out. We're covering all the artists on the ballot. This episode is a long awaited one. As our listeners know, I have gone rogue many times just to try to make a case for this band, but we've got a full real deal artist episode, and let's bring in our guest who's going to help us out. Educator, historian, DJ, self-described funk head, and the author of books like Funk, The Music, The People, and The Rhythm of the One. Welcome to the show, Ricky Vincent. Ricky, welcome.
Hey, thank you for having me here, Joe and Kristen.
Hello.
Any chance to talk about my super funky heroes is a wonderful day, and Kool and the Gang were some of my first.
Excellent.
Amazing. Well,
before we get to that, we're going to talk about the Hall a little bit. You know, the Hall of Fame for a lot of people is a peripheral institution, one that alleges to have importance and yet not always on the forefront of people's minds. So I'm curious, when it comes to your relationship with the Hall, is it something you pay attention to at all? Have you seen an induction ceremony on TV, a clip online? Where are you coming in for this conversation?
It's a love-hate thing. Because we're sort of past that first wave where all these kind of soul R&B pioneers were sort of in at the same time as everybody else. When the first, when Aretha Franklin went in and folks like that. I said, yeah, that makes sense. There was this cohabitation, this influencing that went on through all the artists in the 60s and blues, rhythm and blues, all that made sense in terms of sort of ideas of foundational rock and roll. And I was like, okay. But then somehow things started to kind of thin out, and I didn't see the artists that I understood to be dominant and influencing and household names and have songs that many of us grew up on, whether we knew who they were or not. And I was like, a lot of these folks are getting missed.
Mm-hmm.
And it started to get worse as far as I was concerned. Hope was renewed when Parliament Funkadelic George Clinton was put in 1997, mm-hmm. Along with, I think, Joni Mitchell was at the same time. And I'm like, well, yes. If it's her that long, well, okay, these things happen. But from my vantage point, there are a lot of bands. And I think, Joe, you probably know, Parliament Funkadelic is probably the biggest artist to get in the Hall. I know they had a maximum of 16 members were allowed to get a trophy. And it could have been twice that easily that night.
Right. Yeah. When you go to the museum and you look at the, you can go and see the plaques where they have the bands and the artists, and for the bands, you have a list of the members, and the P-Funk one takes up a lot of real estate because you've got quite a few members, in there. And as you said, they're, you could make an argument that there could be more, but yeah, they certainly inducted, many, crucial members of that group.
Well, which is really exciting because I feel like so often when you're having like larger groups or just bands in general, in the hall's history, they tend to be predominantly white. And so to have a very large group that is, you know, multiracial and more predominantly black is like an exciting thing to see in some ways too. Mm-hmm.
Well, I wanted more of that excitement. I was more bands that, you know, that not only that I grew up with, but I knew were crucial to other artists' development. And like I said, the household names and songs that were household names. So artists, individual artists made it. I remember I got to interview Bill Withers around 2000.
Oh, wow.
And he was a wonderful guy, but he was salty that everybody knew his songs and was covering his songs, but wasn't getting the whiff of the Hall of Fame. And eventually he did. And Stevie Wonder introduced him and he got up there and said, "Stevie Wonder knows who I am." I'm like, "You're Bill Withers." And then pretty soon he exhaled and he left us. It was almost like he was holding his breath until he got that level of recognition.
Mm-hmm.
And I, you know, I was pushing for him and, you know, and hoping, but I also realized that it's a different thing to recognize a band because you're not spotlighting, you know, the star. And a lot of, if you want to say it, if you will, rock is involved in our idolization of that person in the spotlight. And we all do that. I ran across that. I was checking some documentary on hip hop and it was this rapper and that rapper. And then De La Soul was there. I'm like, "Oh, well, which of those guys, who are they? Who?" I had forgotten their name. And even their names are kind of wacky. Trugoy.
And, yeah, yogurt backwards.
Like, okay. But, you know, if you're going to really address a band, you're going to sort of have to move the spotlight back and deal with all of the people, because it was a collective thing going in and a collective thing coming out. And a lot of us appreciated just that. Okay, Lionel Richie's in front of the Commodores, but we wanted the Commodores. We wanted everything, you know? Rufus and Chaka Khan, we love Chaka, but she did have that band, what actually existed before they brought Chaka in. They were Rufus. They were a self-contained group. Mm-hmm. And so a lot of folks were doing that. And so I had just a band sensibility coming up. I'm from the Bay Area. Sly and the Family Stone, Tower Power. There were some really wild-looking and sounding bands where I was, you know, in high school. And actually, Am Central Station played a free concert at Berkeley High School in 1977. Changed my life forever. So, but I was already going down that rabbit hole anyway. And, you know, we knew who the leader was, Larry Graham. Took his bass out and did these Hendrixian things to the bass in terms of animating it and doing things to turn it into an earthquake machine and all that stuff. But it was the whole band. The whole idea was the group. And so I was kind of back and forth with the hall waiting for them to catch up. And
right. Yeah. I mean, what you said about bands versus, you know, the names we've seen recently, and you just brought up Lionel Richie and Chaka Khan, both inducted very recently and inducted by themselves, sadly, mm-hmm. at the expense of these bands who were crucial to their sound in the beginning. And, you know, it's a personal thing, but I prefer the discography of Rufus and Chaka to Chaka solo, to Commodores, to Lionel Richie. I just think there's more depth there. I mean, again, I'll acknowledge that as a matter of taste, but it's too bad when you could induct all these great artists and it would still include the solo artist, but obviously doing just the solo artist, you don't get as many. And it's just a shame when you see it.
Yeah, and it reinforces this kind of mythology of this sort of beyond reproach individual. But they're all who they are because of their interactions with others.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's the
collective. It all down.
Yeah, right. Well, I would love to know, to get an additional sense of your taste and sensibilities. If you had a ballot, if you received this year's ballot and you got to vote for up to seven artists on this year's ballot, who would you pick and why?
Cher. Mm-hmm. I'll have to give it to Eric B. and Rakim.
Mm-hmm.
Peter Frampton was so big when I was getting into the music. That don't mean he was good, but he was big. Peter Frampton. I had a thing for Jane's Addiction when they started out. I don't know how well they sustained what they did.
They didn't really, to be frank.
Okay. Well, all right. So let me keep moving. Lenny Kravitz, I would put him in just because of his variety and consistency of his work. Ozzy Osbourne on reputation. Some of these people are on reputation rather than actual chart movement.
Mm-hmm.
Sade is just a living slice of heaven. I just do that for Sade. Sinead O'Connor is a slice of reality, mm-hmm. which rock always needs. So I would put her in there. I don't know if that's seven yet.
Yeah, who we got? We're looking at Kool and the Gang, Lenny, Sinead, Sade, Eric B. and Rakim, Cher.
He had said, yeah.
So, yeah, maybe you'd get one more.
One more. Man, I was owner of a lonely heart. Can I let somebody in on one song?
Well, that's the band.
That's,
yes.
Yes, they're in.
I always thought it was Foreigner. Well, okay.
But I guess not. Right, so then, that's a no.
Them, no, listen, but I remember them, but not enough. I'll give them credit for having a broad range. And if these are nominees, Mariah Carey is a pop star. So Mariah Carey.
Okay. Yeah.
All right.
There we go. That's a good list. Get a sense of how your mind works and your sensibility and your tastes. But I
dig A Tribe Called Quest, but I have a feeling only one rap group a year is going to show up.
Well, this year, the thing that has changed from years in past is that you can pick up to seven. It used to be you could only pick five. And I think there was more feeling that you would have to just pick a lane. You could only pick one hip hop artist. You could only pick one from each category or whatever, you know, one female solo vocalist, et cetera. But this year, because there's more votes available, I mean, we're hoping that it doesn't have to be just one. Although, you know, Eric B. and Rakim have not the name recognition that, you know, usually you need to get in through the ballot.
To convince these voters? Yeah, usually
yes.
It has to be Jay-Z level, Eminem level. And, you know, hopefully they gradually we'll get to a place where that doesn't have to be the requirement. You know, because Tribe and Eric B. and Rakim are foundational and very important, but they're not as big as Tupac or Biggie, you know?
But what is big at some point? I mean...
It means, does my mom know who they are? You know, cause some of these voters will tell you it's... you're not dealing with the most knowledgeable, especially when it comes to hip hop. And so that's just the trend we've seen. But, you know, we cross our fingers that those trends change over time.
And yeah, well, and put Tribe Called Quest in there anyway, then, because I'm a big fan. I mean, I did the logic and I said, well, if there was, you know, if I'm at the big festival and Tribe Called Quest is in one direction and Eric B. and Rakim isn't the other, I'll go check out Eric B. and Rakim because they have that edge that on a good day kind of sticks with you.
Yeah,
Tribe Called Quest is a fun party band group act. Although we lost
Fife.
Yeah,
many people, but mm-hmm. in an imaginary situation. But it doesn't matter. They're both great. And,
there's room for them both at the end of the day.
But see, here's my thing, you guys. Those hip hop acts, I mean, they're important and they're well known and they're stars. But they were rapping over some other record.
Interesting. And I think that we are going to be talking about that today. Yes.
You know, are the ones that need to be recognized, because if it wasn't for those records, these people would be, you know, I don't know, rapping over Sean Cassidy records. I don't know. So that's always my thing. And my first real time I bugged on Tribe Called Quest is when they did a tune called The Scenario, where they're sampling a rare early Kool and the Gang song, Soul Vibration. Alarm. Wait, okay. And that tells me they are about that stuff. Mm-hmm. And if you deal with a lot of the hip hoppers who at the time, the DJ was the force, the centerpiece of beginning of hip hop. Eric B and Rakim, nobody knows who Eric B is. The DJ's name went first back then.
Right.
Jazzy Jeff and the Fresh Prince. The DJ's name went first. Right? It's been that's how it started. Because the DJ delivered the goods, made the vibe, made the beat, and then here comes the
MC over it, kind
of
put on the icing.
Maybe one of these days, I don't know if it's happened, a DJ will get in, like Prince Paul, who did all those samples on the De La Soul record, 3 Feet High and Rising.
Well, you know, Jam Master Jay is in with Run DMC. And so
DJ Cool Herc got in.
No, that's right.
I mean,
let the rest of them follow. Because that basically, you guys, when I start to teach music history and I get into how much the dance took over the world, how much Soul Train took over the world, how many people wanted to be on Soul Train, so they had to make Disco Train, they had to just follow it up. I was like, everybody wanted the beats. By the middle 70s, the beats were so important. Folks didn't care about the man anymore. They had to have the beats. So the DJ became the delivery system to bring those beats. And the DJ would produce. DJ first was mixing in discos, then they would produce songs, and then they would make songs. And now EDM is a Grammy Award winning category because it's built by DJs. Mm-hmm. And so DJ takes over. So at some level, at some point, I think Kool Herc is a good starting point, and then other DJs could follow.
Yeah. And let's not forget, the first hip hop inductee was Grandmaster Flash, who was a DJ. So, but you know, talking about hip hop, let's go back to, you know, what you had mentioned, which is that, you know, these groups, they sampled a lot of great bands. And of course, this episode, we are talking about one of the foremost groups in that category, one of the most sampled groups of all time, Kool and the Gang. And I would love to know what your history is with that group, if you remember the first time you heard them, or just generally what they mean to you personally.
Kool and the Gang transformed my life because they took the raw power of that James Brown thing, which I was probably scared of at 10 years old, and they made it accessible. And I remember in the ninth grade, after school, hearing Jungle Boogie real loud. It maybe had been out for a few months. And I said, wait a minute. Wait, these are the same guys that did funky stuff. These are the same guys that did Hollywood Swinging. Wait a minute. This thing is going through me, in and out. And I did two things. I bugged out. And then that stuff at the end with the, you know, can we be technical, that, you know, improvisational, you know, rhythmic thing that, what was his name? The funky man, Donald Boyce. That was the guy doing
it. It was
that.
Like their roadie, right?
Their roadie. Yeah. I mean, that's a heck of a job. I was like, I could do that job. Let me do that again. Show up once a night and go,
yeah.
I could do that. And so I vibed on it, and then I started to study it. I was like, wait a minute, that horn arrangement. There's a whole sort of elaborate thing going on while you're feeling this raw vibe. And I was like, wait, there was this tension. between sort of the intellect and the emotion around this funk they were making. And I was like, wait, this is something I could pursue. So maybe one of the first albums I ever bought was Wild and Peaceful, the first album. And at that time, you know, you're cheap. You don't want to spend any money. A record has to have at least two and maybe three hits before you're ready to go down to the record store and the hall and spend your $4 or $5 on that thing. And so when I got it, it did both. It had all this raw power to it, but then it had all this weird jazz. And I was like, I'm not ready for this. I'm a kid. I want, you know, just give me 8 songs that just thunder and groove on me. But they didn't do that. They did weird, kind of off kilter, strange, jazzy stuff. And Wild and Peaceful, the title cut, is this 9-minute mellow thing. I don't want mellow. I'm 12 years old. So I want the jam. But so I understood. They were, eventually I realized that's what jazz artists always want to do. They want to like make you go to another musical level, make you follow them to the next place. That's what the best belligerent jazz artists always did. They sort of challenged you. And so I was like, wait, these guys are grooving. They're on the radio, but they're doing that same kind of challenging, musical challenging that I respected, usually skipped at the record store, but I respected it. And so they gave me both. They allowed me to sort of intellectually appreciate this music and just on a pure, raw vibe, appreciate the music. And they had so much style. The backside of the Wild and Peaceful album is all 7 of the original members in a sort of coming out of a silhouette type of thing. It's in black and white, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. And I just stared at them. I just studied them. I was like, man, Funky George, that was George Brown, the drummer. And then some guy, Clay E.X. Smith, the guitarist. And I could tell he was a specially genius, brilliant talent on More Funky Stuff, which was the B-side, the single flip side of Funky Stuff. And he does he holds a guitar rhythm. They just break down his ding, 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 ding. And I'm like, doesn't he get tired? He can hold that perfectly. And then they did Summer Madness, which was a hypnotic thing that was on a level of jazz that people are still trying to catch up to. And I was like, these guys, they had these hints of how well they could do standards or mainstream music or pop music. They did 2 live albums early in their run.
Right, right.
And they did these pop covers. They did pop songs, standards. And they could hit them so well. I was like, you know, I had no idea what their future was, but I was like, these guys are kind of overqualified to do what they're doing, which is radio funky R&B in the early 70s.
Right.
Although you're all in Joe's categories now. You're talking about albums, you're talking about songs, you're talking about influence.
I mean, it's all there. And I want to talk a little bit about the beginnings of the group. And you mentioned these guys, you know, they've got jazz in their blood, and these were high schoolers in Jersey City in 1964. Put together, they just wanted to have an instrumental group to play jazz and soul songs, and they were maniacs about jazz, so of course they called their group Jazziacs.
I did not know that.
That's the wow. And they're kids.
I mean that really does sound like a group of high school jazz kids.
Yep.
Hi, everybody. We're the Jazziacs. I mean, it was the 60s, so it probably was not feeling as corny as that would now, you know. But
yeah,
it lets you know who they were. And there were a mix. This is what I loved about the bands back then. There would be one or two people that were like real students, real music students that read, that charted songs, did all that. And then there were always folks at the other end who just showed up, smoked whatever was being passed around, and then just vibed on some, you know, did some and left. And they were part of the group also. There was like the freestyle component and mm-hmm. Meticulous arranging component. And I think it was Ronald Bell and Clay were the ones that were real serious about that. And I'm not going to say the others were just trifling around, but they were like, you know, come and jam with us, which was code for come and practice, come and get better, come and study. Mm-hmm. And we'll do this stuff and we'll get into it. And so, you know, just their whole approach was just, I mean, it was common, but obviously there's a way their story came together where all the pieces fit.
Yes.
And, you know, a lot of bands, I don't really like to talk about bands that don't make it, but they're usually as good as the weakest link in the band. And if somebody's in the band and just can't cut it on bass, if you keep them, that band's not going to go that far.
Mm-hmm.
If you suck it up and fire your cousin, you know, and move on, you know, these things happen. And so Kool & the Gang was one of those groups where all those pieces fit just so fluidly. They thrive without a lead singer.
And right. Yeah. When you listen to those early songs, you know, they're either instrumental or it's kind of gang vocals.
It's gang vocals. Rick West did do that Hollywood swing in, I remember not too long ago, you know, went to a theater and saw the Kool & the Gang show. I always wanted to. I can't hit those notes. But
yeah, and he does a good job.
And I saw the Kool & the Gang show.
I used to wonder how come Rick didn't do more of those. But bottom line is most of them could sing, but none of them wanted to be a lead singer. That's a special constitution you have to have.
Yes, for sure. And, you know, when you talk about it's only as good as its weakest link, there were a lot of links in this band when they started out. A lot of members, you know, at the core is Cool himself, Robert Bell, and his brother, Ronald, who, as you said, was, you know, really into jazz and very serious about the music. And he had Spike Mickens on trumpet. Dennis Thomas, DT, on sax, the aforementioned Ricky West, who's doing keys and occasional vocals, George Funky Brown on drums, and Cletus, sometimes Charles Smith, on guitar. And so that was the original lineup and the lineup that would exist for a long stretch. And even the you know, the Bell brothers had a connection to through their father, who was we pulled out some vinyl.
Yeah, I was looking for my Wild and Peaceful, my recent purchase, because my original is all so worn, you don't even want to touch it. But this,
right.
This
they're the guys.
This is one with Summer Madness on it, and it was really a spiritual record, Light of Worlds. And so that was a thing, but I didn't know this. And I think this is the only one of its kind. If you're a vinyl collector, Joe, most of us know a gatefold when we see it, right?
Mm-hmm.
But somehow the thing inside this thing opens up. So it's a whole extra couple panels in black and white with a picture of a galaxy with the band in the middle of the galaxy there and the sun's corona and then all the credits. And at the time, I just thought that was normal. But another group do something with their, you know, the format of the record. And people were very, innovative back then, you know, and did a lot with the cardboard format of vinyl covers to really say things and do things. Mm-hmm. So I was spoiled out the gate because I was
sure.
Wild and Peaceful was straightforward. And then that one, and then Spirit of the Boogie came out, and I was like, yeah, they're deep, but they're raw funk at the same time. And again, that tension of like intellect and in emotion and instinct, you know, they knew how to capture that.
And you know, let me walk us up to, you know, them being these kids, these jazzy acts, to being Kool & the Gang. You know, they were serious about it from a young age. They were the opening act for a jazz night every Sunday. And they had a few different names, the Soul Town Band or the New Dimensions. After a few years, they became Cool in the Flames, but their manager thought they shouldn't get confused with the Famous Flames, a little bit too close to the fire. Don't get too close to the sun here. And it's Flames. So in 69, that is when they became Cool and the Gang. And that is the point when they begin. And I want to get into the music. I want to get into the songs. And I have these categories that we evaluate artists, each episode to see, their merits as a possible inductee and potentially their future as inductees. So let's take a quick break first, and then when we come back, we will jump into Cool and the Gang. Don't go anywhere.
Hello, Pantheon Podcast listeners. Christian Swain here to tell you more about my experience with Raycon earbuds. Our family now has three pairs of Raycon earbuds around the house, and my wife just grabbed a pair of the Headphone Pros to replace some headphones from a company that was double the price. And yes, she loves them. Now, if you haven't pulled the trigger on a pair of Raycons, or even if you have but you're in the market for another pair because they're just that good, well, now is the time to check them out, because they just launched their upgraded model of the best-selling everyday earbuds. With Raycon's upgraded everyday earbuds, now you also get active noise cancellation, ergonomic design, and multi-point connectivity that lets you pair with two devices at once. New quick charge function, three customizable sound styles, plus awareness mode. Available in a variety of vibrant new colors to complement any and all skin tones. I even have a pair of earbuds in a cool green color. I have tried just about every earbud known to humankind, and these Raycons are fantastic. Seriously, if you've been wanting to check out Raycons, there truly is no better time. You're going to ask yourself why you didn't check them out sooner, and Raycon offers a 30-day happiness guarantee. So, what are you waiting for? Go to buyraycon.com/pantheon today to get 20% off your Raycon order, plus free shipping. That's right, you'll get 20% off and free shipping at buyraycon.com/pantheon. buyraycon.com/pantheon.
Welcome back to the show, everybody. We hope you had a nice break. We hope over your break you figured out the right name for you.
There you go.
If maybe you were like, maybe I'm a jazzy act. Maybe I'm a flame.
You figured it out. Welcome to the gang. You've been jumped in. Here you are.
Let me give some hall context for Cool and the Gang before we jump in. They've been eligible for the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame as of 1995. Because their self-titled album was released in 1969. And it did feature a self-titled song. We do love to see that. A band self-titled album, yep. Self-titled song, first track, first single, just called Cool and the Gang. And it is a great song, and I do like it. And they will still play it, not in full, but... You know, maybe in the middle of Jungle Boogie, they'll spring some of the OG, the original self-titled song. Cool and the Gang have never been on a ballot before, which is shocking. And there's no involvement, from what I can tell, any members in any ceremonies, and they've never been brought out to induct anyone or to play. So this is they're new to the Hall world, and we've got them on a ballot, though. And as our listeners know, I'm extremely excited. Let's get into the categories, and we'll start with iconic / majorly recognizable songs. And I want to go in order so we can kind of tell the story of Cool and the Gang by going through these big songs. And I also want to stop along the way with songs that maybe aren't recognizable as Cool and the Gang songs, but we might know as notably sampled in hip hop, because I think that's important.
Good to add that. To the line there.
I think so. And so, you know, when this group starts, they don't really make a huge mark at first. They release that first studio album with a self-titled song on it. And what I'll point out from this record is they've got a song called Give It Up. which was not released as a single, but is significant, especially when we talk about this particular ballot. It's been sampled a lot, but most notably, their ballot mates, Eric B. and Rakim, used it on Don't Sweat the Technique.
Don't Sweat the Technique.
Nice pairing there.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Now, they have that first album. Like you said, they had those two live albums early on with
their... Well, I also want to mention, Joe, every now and then I'm in a soul jazz bag and I get into Lou Donaldson and some of the organ players. Grant Green is like the king of that kind of smooth soul jazz where you do covers of R&B and their extended just sort of jazz instrumentals. And one of his biggest records is Let the Music Take the Mind. From that Hula and the Gang album. And there are others, and there's a group, I think Funk Incorporated, who isn't a well-known group, but they do like an 8-9 minute version of that song. And right out the gate, Hula and the Gang caught the attention of other kind of, let's just say, ambitious kind of jazz crossover artists looking to see how to do that, looking to see how that was done. And so they were already leaders in a subset of a subset of that, those kind of soul jazz people, which now they're getting more of their due. I mean, maybe one day, I don't know if you've ever broached this, maybe George Benson would get in. He's got the pop hits.
He does have the pop hits.
Legacy. But that's a lot of what he was doing at first, you know, mm-hmm. just real groovy lounge, you know, covers of well-known jazzy R&B songs and stuff like that. So
yeah, I mean, well, first we've got to get Cool in the Gang, and this is, you know, its
we'll
own
start a path.
Journey.
Clear a
yeah.
path here. But yeah, you know, Let the Music Take Your Mind, like the self-titled debut single. You know, they're making the Hot 100, and they're not making the Top 40, and you know, they both were number 19 on the soul singles charts at the time. And so they're not exactly making a huge splash, but it's, you know, it's being recognized, like you say. People are taking notice. And then after that, they do have the two live albums, and their manager at the time, Gene Redd, is producing and helping them write before they part ways. And they start to add vocals a little bit to the songs, but slowly, because they were very much, you know, that Cool in the Gang song is a complete instrumental. But then they start self-producing and becoming more of a self-sufficient group, right? And they released two more studio albums by 1972. And we've brought it up before, but on one of those albums is a song, Soul Vibrations. Which, again, this one's not a single, not a hit, but is notable because of its sampling. So there's a song by a guy named Joe Budden called Pump It Up.
Pump it up. Pump it up, you came to get it drunk with a dame, but shit is drunk, you came
which
to
is, that's great. As soon as you hear that, I mean, I was listening to the mix that Joe had made to kind of like prep for this episode, and I was like, you know, Soul Vibration starts, and I was like, oh, that's that. What song is that? And then I was like, oh, yeah. And then I listened to the next song and I was like, that is just such an iconic horn lick. What would you call that? A horn riff?
Line.
You know, line. Unbelievable. Yeah, and I mean, just like gets you hyped.
Pumped up, maybe?
Pumped up, you might say.
But that song, it like hangs completely on that riff.
Yes.
That Joe Budden song.
Yes.
You know, it's all about that sample.
And Soul Vibrations just stays in a pocket. Just the whole, I don't know if there's a bridge or anything. It just stay down and it's like, it's basement music, late in the party, groove, jam. And you can either do that or you can't. And Cool in the Gang could do that. Mm-hmm. And that was a joy to discover that blue album, Music is the Message. Mm-hmm. And I know folks were really excited about, there was a high energy song on there called Love the Life You Live, so you can live the life you love, which is Sly and the Family Stone School, but they were doing their thing.
Love the life you live, so you can live a life.
I remember people lamenting that it was a 5-minute song broken into part one and part two.
Yes.
With a gap in the middle.
Right.
And I'm like, what is going on? If you had the single, you got side one and side two, and everybody wanted the whole thing connected. When it finally came out on CD, you got 1 5-minute song. Because that was the demand, the supply and demand. People wanted the whole groove. But at the time, 72, what are you trying to do? You're trying to get on the radio with your single.
Yeah, they're trying. And, you know, despite the fact that these songs on these records would be important to samples later, this all of this output in the beginning yields, you know, at best, modest hits, especially relatively. And, you know, at the time, it was called the Hot Soul Single Chart. And that's where they were doing their.
That was what the chart. These chart names have always got me twisted.
And we will track it as we go through
my gosh.
The gang, because the names continue to change.
Across all of them.
Yeah.
This is the Hot Soul Single Chart.
Hot Soul Singles, yeah.
Okay,
early 70s.
Because I remember when we've done like more early influence episodes and things like that. Like they used to be called
Race Records.
There was the Race Records. And
then in the 80s, Hot Black Singles, which we will get
what?
To.
What? I'm so sorry. Okay, intrigued. Okay, so we're at the Smooth and Silky Soul.
The soul, Hot Soul Singles. At
Hot
this
Soul
moment.
Singles.
Hot
okay.
Soul Singles.
Hot Soul Singles. All right, I'll put an ad in that section. No problem.
No, it's not until you get to 1973 and the album Wild and Peaceful. They're 4th studio album that you get the first major hit and one of the most recognizable still in their catalog, which is Jungle Boogie.
The first single was Funky Stuff.
Right, which we,
and
yes.
That whistle started everything out.
Yes.
That was the party starter.
Funky Stuff was their first to crack the top 40. I would say compared to Jungle Boogie, not as heard now, but, you know, went to a modest 29 on the Hot 100, first to crack the top 5 on the Soul Singles Chart. Now, this is another one. We get back to the sampling, that opening horn part you hear. You could also hear on the Beastie Boys' first single.
Yes.
Hold It Now.
Hold it now. Hold it now. Which is a sample extravaganza.
Yes. And I'd also argue, and I don't know that I've seen this in writing anywhere, but on Funky Stuff, you hear consistently the guys go, party. Which I think is the template for You Gotta Fight for Your Right to Party by the Beastie Boys. The exact same way they say it is the way Kool and the Gang did it on Funky Stuff. And
well, you know, those guys have been listening to old school beats for years when they were putting those real heavy sample laden Beastie Boys albums together.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So I would buy that.
It just sounds like, yeah, that especially that first album, they were cribbing from Kool and the Gang quite a bit. But really, it is Jungle Boogie off that album that is one that continues to endure and is such a representative funk song from that era of funk. You know, and this went to number 4 on the Hot 100, number 2 on the Soul Singles Chart. It went gold as a single. And the story for Jungle Boogie is, you know, the group hadn't had a gigantic hit. And the record company was really wanting one from the guys, and they suggested they do a song like Manu Dibango's Soul Makossa, which was a big hit at the time.
Uh-huh.
And they even suggested that they cover it.
Right. And they didn't want to do a cover, but I think everybody was kind of bugged out on Manu Dibango, really, because Michael Jackson messed with that. But that everybody could hear the James Brown idolatry in it. It was like, wait a minute, this guy's from Cameroon. This is sort of Africa giving his love to James Brown funk, and it goes back, it comes back, and then the Kool and the Gang sees that and said, well, we gotta, or like I said, the record people said, you know, pay attention to this. We all heard it. And they said, okay, well, we got to do our own version of that, go back to the jungle and do the Jungle Boogie. And it made things happen. And I think one of them said all three of those songs, Funky Stuff, Jungle Boogie, and Hollywood Swingin', were all done at the same session.
Crazy.
Oh, wow.
And but that got them in the vibe, and they were able to do things. And this is what happens when you have master musicians. They found a groove, and then all of a sudden they're going, dun, 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 dun. They're doing all this stuff that quietly is real complex if you were to chart it.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, we're just too busy vibing, dancing, going, heck of blah, 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 blah. I mean, we're just having fun. But, and so it was, everything came together for them and for that. And yeah, and it's funny that Jungle Boogie stands out so much because it sort of fit really well in this album called Wild and Peaceful, with this painting of a jungle scene on the front of it that gave people a real kind of sense of the life that's going on. And, you know, we all knew they were from the New York area, and we all know now how urbanized the hip hop experience was, but Hooligan Gang was just a breath of like, whoa, you guys are hitting and you're taking us somewhere. You're hitting here where we are and you're taking us there. And so I don't know anybody that says, I don't really like Jungle Boogie.
I mean, that is truly that. What is there to not, I can't imagine. Also, that song makes you want to dance. It makes you want to groove. Like, it is an undeniable, you know, that is the sound of just boogie. I mean, like, it really makes you want to go. Like, mm-hmm. You can't, nobody
and you know, it's,
that.
It's in famously in Pulp Fiction.
Yes. That was the other thing. I feel like that's when that song really came into my, I'm sure I knew of it, but like, I remember the Pulp Fiction soundtrack loomed very large for me when it came out. And that was like, definitely the, like one of those highlights where I was like, how did I never really know this song before? And then I was like, oof, they listened to this kind of music in the 70s.
That's right. And, and when EPMD showed up in 87, maybe the single You Got to Chill came out in 1987, but I think they sampled Jungle Boogie on that. You got to chill. On one of their first big songs off of that first big album. And I felt it was a grand statement to say, yes, you're sampling Zap, more bounce than the ounce, but you hear those horn rips in the middle of You Got Such, and it was like, yeah, that's their New York affiliation they're given to let everybody know this is the standard, this is the template that we built our beats from.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And speaking of samples, and we've mentioned already that they just cranked these songs out in a session, but you know, we got to talk a little bit about Hollywood Swingin'. I mean, number 6 on the Hot 100, their first number 1 on the Soul Singles chart. This one also went gold, absolute classic. And like you said, it's got Ricky doing some vocals, kind of rare for them, and he has got a good voice. But I really think the legacy of this song is the opening horn fanfare. Which is so pivotal. Oof. To, at the very least, I can think of two kind of iconic hip hop songs. There's Let Me Clear My Throat by DJ Kool with a K in 1996. And then in 1997, you get the song Feel So Good by Mace. What you know about and both out, those man. Songs, you know, it's the horns make it. They start it, and then it's all based off. They're almost, I mean, especially Feel So Good is almost like a cover because they're just kind of rapping over the song. But I think that just speaks to that riff is so good. You can continue to make new songs out of it, you know, decades later.
Yep.
I was always sprung on the arrangement that don't. The way the bass line and the rhythm guitar are doing different things, but they are perfectly in sync. Okay. Mm-hmm. And so I was always enjoying how, I don't know what the musicological term is, how the good bands could groove. A lot of the James Brown tracks did that, where the instruments would be doing something. You'd have to dig in and listen and be like, wait a minute, that guitar is doing something way over there and the horns are doing something way over there. When you lean back, it's all, you know, one kind of grooving stew coming at you. So I dug that. I was all into his vocals. And then that end percussion breakdown thing towards the end. Every time I heard it, I was like, first of all, give me the 8-minute version of that. That's what I want.
Please.
I want that extended percussion. Give me that. And then when I started to hear go-go beats, when I heard Chuck Brown and we're busting loose. It seemed like there's a whole kind of subgenre of just extended percussion-driven funk beats. And Washington, D.C.'s go-go sound is basically an entire world of that. And I'm like, you know, it kind of sounds like they all started from that second half of Hollywood Swinging by Kool and the Gang.
Well, you know, you mentioned that bass line. You know, it starts doom, 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 doom. And someone who has acknowledged that beginning of the bass line, doom, 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 a Good Times bassline.
Oh.
Which then that, you know, if we talk about importance to hip hop, like obviously that's the foundation for Rapper's Delight. And, you know, we draw these lines back. It all leads to Kool & the Gang, baby.
Yeah. Well, Kool & the Gang will say it came from James Brown, but then
right. Yeah. And the line keeps going.
They put, they put such a thing on it because they were capable of doing so many things. They went in so many directions. And I couldn't understand why they weren't better recognized, even though they had those pop hits.
Right.
I couldn't understand at the time. How come they're not better recognized, even among the peers that were bands like Earth, Wind & Fire, who had sort of targeted a little more directly pop mainstream targeted approach.
Well, you know, that album that based on the, you know, the strength of the, especially those two monster hits, you know, that album went gold, and, you know, they were a big charting band at that point. And then in 74, the next year, they had Light of the Worlds, also went gold. And on it is that incredible instrumental track, Summer Madness.
Which seems like the whole record is built to set that up.
Mm-hmm.
Like they were in a spiritual place, and that means a lot because they had the pop success. And what are you going to do? You've got these radio hits, Wild and Peaceful hits, boom, 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 boom. They could have gone in a lot of directions, and they got, I guess, philosophical about it, spiritual about it. And, you know, other artists were doing that. And I mentioned Earth, Wind & Fire, and people were trying to make bigger statements and things. And they just, it seemed like all the pieces fell into place. The band was in effect. The new sounds were there. All the technology, the credits on that album with Ronald Bell playing the Mellotron. What's a Mellotron? That's a cool name. So that was kind of cool. And that synthesizer thing that almost no one has tried to build on in terms of that, you know, not even jazz artists or jazz fusion people. They haven't really tried to mess with it really. And I remember in 1974 hearing that, I was like, people are still going to be catching up to this 50 years from now. And here we are, 50 years from now.
Yes, here we are.
Yes. And that song, I mean, what a true vibe. I mean, the song is a vibe. It sounds like it's funny too. It's like the name of the song. It sounds like the name of the song, and also Mellotron. It sounds like the sound that it makes. You know, I feel like we're really in some onomatopoeia type area. Like it is
madness. It keeps going up those octaves, and every time I think it's done, it keeps going for that next one. And you know, this song was not released as a single initially. It didn't get released as a single until it was technically a B-side a year later, off of the next album, Spirit of the Boogie. Mm-hmm. But you know, even though it wasn't a single, it was a B-side later, you know, I think it's one of their most iconic. And again, when we talk about samples, you know, DJ Jazzy Jeff and the Fresh Prince, Summertime from 1991 comes to mind.
Summers of the past, adjust the bass and let the Alpine blast. Pop in my CD and let me run around and put your car on cruise and lay back because it's summertime.
And then there's a song from 1994, You Know How We Do It, from Ice Cube, another big one.
Ain't no stopping, foe hopping, ass dropping, coup the bill, my troop can kill, fool, I got skills.
Also, this song was in Rocky. It's like got placement in, you know, the best picture winner of 1976, Rocky.
That thing has a life of its own. And it's interesting because if you know, are into kind of the smooth jazz and you kind of back in the day, you went into record stores back then. Remember that? You would say, you know, where is that song, Summer Madness? And you're in the jazz section, and you got to go down the other aisle where the soul groups are, where the R&B acts are, and comb through that, because they crossed genres and mastered them. And we knew this by 1974 that Kool & the Gang would and could do that, and I just loved it. I couldn't get enough of how many ways they were coming at it. The song Higher Plane was in there. That was actually a number one R&B hit. It didn't break out any further. It was like, this is actually Confession. That song has this bass line, doom, doo, 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 higher, doom, doo, 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 doo. And I was like, wow, Kool invented that bass. Doom, doo, 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 doo. And it took me a minute before I learned that was all Larry Graham stuff from Sly and the Family Stone years earlier, had amplified that bass groove and everybody was riding that thing. But they did a perfect, stylizing of the funk bass as a spiritual, instrument on there. And so, and they were just growing, and the masters, that's what they do when they're on top. They don't just try to duplicate what they did to get on top. They keep growing. And that one to me really said that. It felt so original, that whole Light of Worlds album.
Yeah, totally. And, you know, they both these albums are very, very successful. And then, you know, after that, the next few years aren't quite as commercially as successful. And, you know, they try leaning into some more disco influenced sounds. Doesn't exactly work for them. But one highlight is they have a song in 1976 called Open Sesame. Which went to number 6 on the Soul Singles chart, didn't crack the top 40, but has the distinction of being one of the few non-Bee Gees tracks on the Saturday Night Fever soundtrack. Biggest albums of that era.
There were a few non-Bee Gees tracks on that album, a double album. There was a lot of, you know, colorful tracks on there. But I remember Open Sesame, because they brought Donald Boyce back. Feel the Spirit. Da, 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 da. He was doing that thing. And the record, I should have brought all my vinyl, open from the middle of the disc. Open.
Like
the
barn doors.
Open Sesame, yeah. Like you're into the Taj Mahal or whatever that ceremonial place was. And so they were dabbling a little on this, I don't know if it's a Middle Eastern thing that they had by then. Some had changed their names to Muslim names. Khalees Bayan, Ronald Bell was Khalees Bayan,
right?
When he changed his name. And so they were just dabbling in that and just making it an accessible vibe. It's heavily musical, that whole album, Open Sesame. A lot of people, that's their favorite album because there's so many different styles. It's just, there's some real mellow stuff, some real elaborate musical stuff going on. And then the single has, you know, a sort of a hard edge because the guy is on top of it. you know, spirit, the Feel the Spirit and all that. But then the disco single doubled down on the dance trend of it all. And, you know, I'm really curious if they had moved on by the time Saturday Night Fever came out and reminded them of that track. If they're you know, saying, well, this is because everybody's at these discos, let's just throw that out there and have some fun and move on. Or if it was a part of a bigger plan, they sort of, I feel like they accidentally cracked the disco monster thing open, just sort of by virtue of being a New York band, being where, you know, everybody was, you know, they could walk. They did this, an album called Everybody's Dancing. I mean, so obviously they were paying attention, but they hadn't sort of refined it, or maybe they weren't all in, you know, because they, here's this jazz band, and then they see, and they become an accomplished hit making act, and then they see the writing on the wall is, and what are you gonna do? And they made the decision to go and get paid.
Yeah, they were masters at adapting. And, you know, around this time, as we get towards the end of the 70s, they're not doing as great as they were at their peak. They're still touring. And, you know, the legend is a promoter for a tour they were doing with the Jacksons was telling them that you're missing an ingredient here, and that ingredient is a lead singer. And so they recruited a guy whose name was James Taylor. But he was not Taylor.
Okay.
And so we do call him JT, though. And that's kind of that's how people refer to him. And
I don't think the other James Taylor would have really fit well on Kool & the Gang.
I'd like to hear it just out of curiosity, but I think you're right. I don't think that's going to fully mesh. But this JT guy did. And they also linked up with a more pop oriented producer, guy named Yumir Deodato. Yeah. And it's interesting to think about, you know, this, by the time this happens, 1979, we are at their 11th studio album, which is, so these guys are so prolific. And, you know, that album, supported by the title track, a huge hit, Ladies Night.
Yes.
Ladies Night goes to number 8 on the Hot 100 and was a number 1 soul single.
And continues to just be a very, you know, just a perennial song. Like, never went anywhere, never going anywhere.
It fits. It just fit. And you wanted, I don't know, it set in motion a whole new world for them. Mm-hmm. And you could hear it, you know, especially people like me who grew up on, you know, soul vibrations and funky stuff. And all of a sudden, dunk, 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 and that electric piano just sort of held you in. The vocals held you in. Everything. It was like you were brought in, and like you were saying, you can't go anywhere. You're right there. And it's sort of, I hated to love it, because I knew it was going in the pop direction and I think a lot of music snobs aren't ready for the success in a different setting or a different context of whatever they're into, because I know a lot of other jazz fans and people, they're fans of acoustic music, Dylan fans, you know, once you go electric, how dare you?
Right.
More people like that. Well, you can't. Well, okay. So it was a thing.
You know, the fact that they got to, and they say this, they're like, we were the first band to have a song called Ladies Night. It's almost like we just got there first. Like someone was going to get there. It's one of those like insanely catchy just titles for a song. It's Ladies Night. Everyone will use this anytime.
Going to be used
There's
forever and ever.
Night.
Yeah.
And you know, the Kool had been hanging out at Studio 54 at the time when he came up with the idea, you know, because they would have Ladies Nights. And I want to point out that there's a big sample for this one. So it's such a heavy sample that it almost qualifies as a cover, but there's a Lil' Kim posse track with a bunch of other female rappers on it from 1997 called Not Tonight. And it's got Missy Elliott and Lisa Left Eye Lopez from TLC. And it's essentially their version of Ladies Night. They're just rapping over the track. And it's a good one. Now, but let's talk about, they've got another big one off this album. And the song's called Too Hot.
Too hot, too hot, too
tough part is a lot of these band members are passing away and doing some, because I did a tribute to Ronald Bell when he died, and a tribute to Funky George when he died, and DT passed away and in the last, just all the last 5 years or so. But Ronald Bell, Carlise Byon, did the horn solo on Too Hot, and he was in some interview saying that, and I was like, wait a minute, you were engaged. That was the first time I really realized they were all in on the clubby pop arranged production that they were doing, because there was a time when they had to apologize for that.
Sure.
You know, the hard fans were like, you know, what are you doing? How, you're selling out. And I remember that. And long ago, when CDs first came out, there was two best ofs. One was their early years, you know, gobbled those up and had the hip hop tracks and stuff. And then the second one was like all their pop stuff. And the writer, I think his name is Cleveland Brown, he's associated with the group, is like their publicist. He wrote the and the first paragraph of that, he was like apologizing for them getting paid, for them money and going in that direction. And I saw them live a couple years ago, and George Brown was still there. He was a drummer, and he came out front and said, we want to thank y'all for supporting all of these pop songs and putting our kids through college. And, you know, what can you say to that? They lived great lives doing what they were doing, all things considered. But it was a, I was there when the shift took place, and the old guard gave him a side eye and then gradually embraced it.
Yeah. You know, it's the kind of vitriol that you wouldn't, I don't think you would see today. I think it would be celebrated, that kind of, we see artists go pop.
It would be a celebration.
Well.
Sorry, I just had to.
Well, shall we go there? I want to talk about, you know, that Ladies Night album was a major success, had those two, especially those two big hits. And Too Hot, even though we know Ladies Night has endured a little bit better than Too Hot, at the time, Too Hot was a little bit higher on the charts, went to number five. And, you know, they, with this big comeback, they won two American Music Awards. And the story goes that night, they had won these awards, they were all hyped. And there's a line in Ladies Night, come on, let's all celebrate. And that was kind of the refrain of the night. And they were singing it. And then they were like, okay, this is morphing into something. And they turned it around. And it turned into potentially their most known song, which is, of course, 1980s Celebration.
Wow. So success begat more success.
That's nice. That's on the Celebrate album. And I mean, gigantic hit, their first number one on the pop charts, number one soul single, went platinum as a single. And it's similar to Ladies Night in the sense that it is based on a hook that had to happen at some point. We needed a celebration song. We needed a song dedicated.
They knew
to
what we needed before we did. And thank you for that.
Out here in the Bay, the Oakland A's, I'm going to talk about where they're going now, but for years and years, after every win in the stadium, boom, they would break into the Celebrate song. And we got real used to that. That was part of the Oakland A's experience. And it's kind of too bad Oakland A's are leaving. Maybe they'll do that when they go to Las Vegas or whatever they're going to do. But that song was iconic then, and it's iconic in people's lives still.
Yeah, I mean, I've mentioned this to Kristen before, but and I don't know if you experienced this too, Kristen, but when it was finally determined that Biden was beating Trump in 2020, you know, I walked around the block here in L.A., and everybody's out, you know, going crazy, celebrating.
It was a truly celebratory atmosphere.
And every other block, you're hearing Celebration by Kool and the Gang. Everybody is pumping it. And, you know, this is a good 40 years later, and it's still the definitive celebration song. And I know at the time, especially in the early 80s, they were using it in, I mean, it was the World Series, the Super Bowl, the NBA Finals, Even, most interestingly, I think, the release of the hostages in Iran was soundtracked to Celebration.
Now, I do think that Celebration is their, you know, most known song, but it is also probably the thing that they are, you know, that works against them in this context of the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, because it is so ubiquitous. And it is also, you know, I mean, I think it was like a Celebrex, like a drug pharmaceutical commercial used it too. You know, it's like, this is where I think in particular, like their popularity and like the saturation, the cultural saturation, it curdles a little bit in the, like, you know, critical minds, and also just kind of like, yeah, is this a Hall of Fame worthy band, or is this the, you know, wedding song, you know, wedding dance floor song,
the
Hall of Fame?
Yeah, you know, purists, like, you know, and it's kind of like what we've been saying, and the fact that Kool and the Gang feel like they need to apologize for some of this stuff, which, you know,
did.
Yeah.
Back in the day. After a while, no.
Right. Mm-hmm. And I'm glad that didn't stick, and that type of kind of shame about these songs that I think are really good. And, you know, they withstand the test of time for a reason, because I think the music, after all, it endures.
It, you know, it does. I mean, but Kool and the Gang endured past through so many musical eras and through so many musical styles. It got to the point where they didn't worry about what the blowback was going to be. I remember I saw them perform at a small club in San Francisco, and JT was still in the band. And I remember he, you know, people were dancing around, having a good time. And he said, what song what do you guys want to hear? And somebody yelled out Funky Granny, which goes way back to the 1972 record. And he's like, won't be no Funky Granny up in here tonight. And, you know, he knew his role.
Yeah.
You know, how to catch people and keep people. And some folks going to miss the boat. And that's okay. And I realized now, and then when I saw them again, not too long ago, maybe 5 years ago, their show was just seamless. It had the pop songs. It had the old school licks, the Summer Madness jazz thing. And it was like there was no the transitions were just so fluid. It's like, this is who they are. And I just thought it was magnificent. Actually, I caught that first. They did the halftime show at the Cotton Bowl one time about 10 years ago on television. Okay. And I was like, these guys could do the Super Bowl halftime show with no problem. All these songs everybody knows.
Right.
And they hit them and they're fun and they're just cool and the Gang.
No, you're right. And, you know, that so that album went platinum, and the Celebrate album, and then the next year they released another platinum album, Something Special, from 1981, which featured a song that I think got back to the funky roots, which is Get Down On It. Yeah, went to number 10 on the pop charts, number 4 on the soul singles, also went gold. And it feels like, you know, this almost feels like a sequel a bit to Jungle Boogie. Like, you've got that same kind of chanting type vocals over a funky beat. It's a little more 80s, and that was a little more 70s, but they feel like, you know, son of Jungle Boogie.
And you've got everybody on the floor. That's what you've got.
Yes.
And then it's one thing if you're sitting on the sideline saying, well, that kind of sounds like da da da. And it's another thing when you're just losing yourself in it. And you're like, you know, this reminds me of something when I got lost myself in middle school at Jungle Boogie. And that's kind of what it was like. And they were already massive. You know, it's kind of incredible that JT can come from, it seems like, nowhere. I'm sure he was apprenticing under
someone,
but to come from nowhere and go straight to the top of the charts. Yes, he rode a band that was eminently qualified, you know, but that was a heck of a thing.
Yeah, and it wasn't like he hopped on a train that had consistently been going up. You know, they were in a bit of a valley, and he was the right ingredient to, yeah, catapult them to heights they had not seen yet. And it's pretty remarkable that the first guy, it works, and everyone agrees.
Yes.
Yeah.
And it seems out of nowhere. I think the Diodato connection is real important, because I had followed his music going all the way back to he did a like a funky version of 2001 Space Odyssey, also Sarathra, and you know the song, the
fanfare, yeah,
the thing that came out of the Stanley Kubrick movie, and he made a R&B version in 1973 that charted. Followed his music as just a, you know, kind of one of those jazz funk people like Bob James, Grover Washington. I was following that whole bag of stuff. And so he got to the point where he was on the radio doing these kind of what becomes known as smooth jazz stuff. But he was really polished. He was a complete artist when he joined Kool & the Gang. Kool & the Gang was a complete artist, but they were ready. They had sort of gotten initiated through Open Sesame into the dance music world, sort of. And then, here comes JT as the icing on that cake.
Yeah. And one just kind of unrelated fact I learned about this Udyr Deodato guy is that he had a daughter who married Stephen Baldwin, and then they had a daughter named Haley Baldwin, and she married Justin Bieber.
Oh, wow.
It's like, oh, okay, so there's this whole lineage of Baldwins, and like the other side is coming from Kool & the Gang's producer from the 80s. Very funny. But one more thing I wanted to say about Get Down on It is there's a song called We Wanna Party With You by Jermaine Dupri and Snoop Dogg.
Get down on it. Say you wanna get down on it. What you wanna do? Get down on it.
And that is another sample, not unlike the Lil' Kim Posse track, where it's almost just a cover. It's basically just Get Down on It, but they're rapping over it. And I can't let a big sample pass us by, because you know there's so many of them, but that is a big one. Now the hot streak that they're on cools down a little bit with 1982's As One, which doesn't really have any singles you still hear today. That album still goes gold. They break with Deodato at that point. They self-produce their next album, 1983's In the Heart, with some help from a guy named Jim Bonenfand. But that doesn't mean they're abandoning their pop turn. In fact, they go full pop ballad with a song called Joanna. Went to number two.
That is correct, yes.
Their second biggest chart hit, and a number one on the, at this time, now we're on the Hot Black Singles. Now we've made it out of the soul singles into the Hot Black Singles. You know, I will say, even though Joanna was a really big hit at the time, I don't hear this one anymore, really.
It's kind a of little evaporated. Too smooth. It yeah. is not necessarily, that's not, the market for that was like brief.
And there's no funk on this one. Like there's kind of no remnants of I would say the other ones for sure that we've been talking about. But as we get to this, it's not exactly, you know, God bless them in their success. And I'm glad they got that bag. But the album goes gold. And yeah, that's one of the most successful, you know. Yeah. Anyway, whatever we want to say about Joanna, Ricky, if you want to say anything about Joanna or best left unsaid, I understand that as well.
Yeah, it wasn't even enough of a thing to be outraged by it. You just said, okay, they double down on, you know, on some of that kind of crossover stuff. And that's fine. I mean, it was more that, you know, you have a whole album, 8-9 tracks. You could put a banger or two on there somewhere. That's not bad. But, you know, what were they doing? They were trying to keep up with Lionel Richie.
Sure.
They were trying to keep up with all the guys wearing in the little velvet, you know, or the pastel colors, you know, smooth, leaning to the side on their album cover thing. It was just that was the market, and these guys were professionals. That's just how I approached it then.
Absolutely, I think that's right. And good for women named Joanna. Let them have a song. You know,
it's about time.
The next album they do, 1984's Emergency, is their most successful. It goes 2 times platinum. It has a lot of big singles. The first single off this album is a, I would say, rocker. It's very guitar driven, and it's called Misled. And it went to number 10 on the Hot 100. It's number 3 as a Hot Black single. It's a heavier song.
That is such a wild. Yeah, it, these categories are insane.
But this Misled is a heavier song than they'd done, and it feels very much in line with like 80s rock. That being said, I wouldn't say this is one that I really know or hear that often. I think it's cool that they have a straightforward rocker. Continues to show that they can do it all. They've got the variety and the ability.
It just feels like they're doing it all from their swimming pool in Beverly Hills. They're doing it all.
Yeah, no, I mean, you're right. Because this is, they are peaking, certainly with when it comes to commercial success. But I really love the next single that they put out from this album, which is a song called Fresh. And this one went to number 9 on the Hot 100. This is a number 1 Hot Black single. And this is just a super fun song that I do still hear from time to time. There's a radio station out here that I hear it on. And I sing it a lot just around the house. I think it's got a great, great hook. And I got to say, I love Fresh.
Oh, that's a bop. That's a good one. That remains fresh. It's fresh. It stays fresh.
Certified fresh.
Exactly.
Certified fresh. Well, Joe, it brings up again and again that question of what is the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame's relationship to fun pop and to, well, we kind of went past that, but to the disco thing in general.
Yeah, you know, we've seen them become much more amenable to it in recent years. In the past, there was definitely a what felt like a bias against pop, even though you saw Madonna, for example, go in on the first year of eligibility. But since then, we've seen Whitney Houston, we've seen Lionel Richie, we've seen bands or artists that are very much in the pop lane. I mean, we've got Mariah Carey on the list this year.
What about Donna Summer? Did she go in?
Yeah, Donna Summer, you know, it was sad. She was on the ballot a lot and did not get in until after she died. And so that was really a shame. But yeah, Donna Summer, absolutely, for disco and pop. Chic famously had a very hard time on the ballot, was nominated 11 times before they just put Nile Rodgers in a side category to kind of encompass Chic and his producing career. So that's, we're in a place though where it seems like any kind of, how do I want to put this, snobbishness against pop has kind of evaporated, and the hall realizes that to discount that would be foolish and doesn't make sense in terms of the story of rock and roll. So the kind of last song I think is worth mentioning here is another cheesy one. It's called Cherish. And it went to number 2, and it was another number 1 on the Hot Black Singles chart, went gold. Another ballad, again, like Joanna, even though it was a big hit at the time, I don't think I ever really hear it anymore. Massive adult contemporary hit, went to number 1 and stayed at the top of those charts for 6 weeks, and would be the biggest adult contemporary hit of the 80s, but that is not very rock and roll. still, though, I mean, so they had these they went really pop, very ballady at the end, but I would say that's pretty much where it ends. Around this time, they participate in Do They Know It's Christmas, the Live Aid charity single. They continue to have hits to some degree for the next 2 years or so, including a few that even hit the top 10, but those have all also disappeared. And then after that, they're pretty much done, especially after JT leaves around 1987.
Okay, yeah, they part way with JT. And they dabble with going, Cool and the Gang goes back to some of their roots in terms of, I think they re-recorded as the Jazzy Acts on a track or two, sort of bootleg around.
That's fun.
Okay. And, you know, and again, it seemed like they eventually they embraced their whole catalog, like I said, if they hadn't before, or maybe fans embraced their whole catalog more. Because, you know, Kool & Gang had some beautiful, mellow songs way back early in the day. Because they did Stop, Look, Listen to Your Heart. There's a jazz tune called Sea of Tranquility. I mean, they knew how to do those. And then, you know, when the 80s came around, they knew. And there's something else about, you know, I'd have to kind of look at all the credits, but a lot of the big bands aren't given credit for their vocals and their vocal arrangements. Earth, Wind, and Fire had great singers. War, who's still waiting to get in, has magnificent singers. Listen to The World is a Ghetto. They can just hit these harmonies perfectly. And a lot of those 80s songs, JT, whether they stacked his vocals or the rest of the band or what, they really had a mastery of vocals. And you kind of have to have that if you're going to have hits. You can't just be a band with, you know, without a lead singer anymore. And they figured that out, and they knew how to put it together. They were masters at every style of music they cared to go into. And that's why, you know, I can't get enough of them to this day. I'm still exploring their craft, you know, their extras, they did an album of remakes of their own work with collaborations with other artists.
Nice. Yeah. I've seen legacy artists do that before. It's a fun way to revisit the hits and some of the best from their catalog.
And now folks are just, I think we've all accepted that, you know, it's fun to hear the original, but it's fun to hear a wacky new take on it.
Yeah, no, totally. So obviously that song category that we spent a lot of time in is a really strong one for them. They have such a catalog. But I want to get to some of these other categories. The next one is albums that are considered all-time classics. You know, I think especially if you're looking at the 70s output, Wild and Peaceful and Light of Worlds, like you said, are kind of the high point of that era. But I'll pose the question to you guys. Do you think Kool & the Gang has any albums listed on Rolling Stone's top 500 albums of all time?
I feel like if they did, it would be Wild and Peaceful. And I don't think it would be high up because I maybe in the redo, but I don't know. I feel like they're like an overlooked band. So I'm not sure. I guess I want to say probably not.
Okay. Ricky, what do you think?
That would be the exact answer I would give. What Kristen just said, I listened to a lot. Look, I've been...
They're in your top 500, for sure.
That box set of the early years and all at once, and because I had collected them all in different formats on CD, and now they're all the same level, all everything, and I can't get enough of it. The Rolling Stone list... I don't know if they'd be fans of Ladies' Night album or Celebrate album. So, I'd have to say the same thing. Maybe Wild and Peaceful, but then I'd have to see the Rolling Stone list. Do you put some Miles Davis albums on that Rolling Stone list? So the jazz angle coming in, if you do that, then Kool & the Gang's early stuff gets more respect.
So I will tell you that, yes, Miles Davis is on that list, but Kool & the Gang is not.
Yeah.
And that bridges us to the next category, critical acclaim. Like you were saying, Kristen, it's like one of the reasons probably why the group didn't make the ballot until recently is it's just they can be overlooked. And I think, you know, they were generally well received in the funk era, but it does get a little dicey in the pop era. You know, rock critics hate what they perceive to be sellouts, even though I think in hindsight for a lot of people that, you know, that music is still great. Well, some of it is corny for sure. But, you know, we view the concept of sellout much differently than we once did. We always check in on Robert Christgau, the self-acclaimed dean of rock critics, to see what kind of things that type of person, which could be indicative of a Rock Hall voter, what they think. He only weighs in when they're making their pop turn, and of course he does not love it. Here's what he says: their funk was as bland as you expected, but he does admit upon a professional re-examination of their latest piece of platinum, I was surprised to recognize all three hits on side one from the radio, but had never wondered who did any of them. And he says, this undependable band is a step ahead of the Commodores.
Oof.
Robert, come on, man.
Wrong side of history, dog.
If you're going to go there, then go there. But I would like to see what he has to say about Wild and Peaceful and Spirit of the Boogie and Light of Worlds today. Just because, and Rolling Stone magazine has had to revise its listings many times.
Sure.
And revisit things many times. And I personally think when there is a renaissance of jazz in pop music, people are going to go back and look at what Kool & the Gang did and how they made James Brown's vision accessible to everyone. Because James had all these jazz musicians in his band, but we just heard and felt James Brown, but it was actually this whole collaborative thing with all these brilliant artists coming together to make something happen that was greater than the sum of the parts.
Agree.
Yeah, and I think the critical evaluation of Kool and the Gang, I would love there to be some sort of reawakening, and I feel like they are overlooked, and you know they're considered to be a party band, and that's, you know, for these critics who want their, you know, dark and sullen poets making music, that the fun stuff and the funky stuff gets pushed to the side, and I don't think that's fair. And you know, and that's speaking of the critics from the 70s and 80s. And I think the critics now are much more open-minded. But let's move out of the critical acclaim category and go to commercial success. I mean, one of the top singles acts of the 80s. I found out Casey Kasem named them the top band of the 80s. Not top funk band, not top soul band,
not soul single or whatever.
No. I mean, it was, he said, and this is a guy who's, I don't think this was an opinion. I think he's looking at chart success, which is crazy to think about.
Which is kind of Casey's place. That's like his territory.
Yeah. And like, he's the authority on that. And I don't know exactly what the measurement was, but I think that's amazing. And, you know, let's take a look at the numbers. Two gold records at their peak in 73 and 74. And as they're getting into the 80s, it's platinum, 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 gold, gold, two times platinum, gold, 21 top 40 hits, 12 top 10 hits, sold 70 million records worldwide. That's a mic drop.
Yeah. We can just move to the next category.
Let's just do it. I mean, you're right. There's nothing else to say. We go to the next category. It's longevity. You know, they come out in 69. They start to have major success in 73 and 74, cools off for a few years, then returns in 79. And their last top 10 hit is 87. I mean, it's amazing longevity. It's about 15 years or so.
They're still putting out music now.
Yes. Mm-hmm. And they're still a great live act. I know we've lost a lot of them, and it's, you know, it's cool and some other guys who have joined later. But, you know, I think also the fact that they were able to maintain relevance when the culture was really changing, when we think about like 73 versus 1987, that is really like the culture changed a few times in that span of time. And the fact that they were able to continue to be a major act that people knew is really astounding.
Their household name, I mean, everybody knows that. They may not know who was in the band, and they might not know the difference between JT and
Cool. They might think JT is cool.
Yeah, they might think Cool is singing. Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
None of that matters because they've sort of imprinted themselves into Americana for better or for worse. And that in and of itself should be kind of the trigger that gets you over the hump.
Mm-hmm. I mean, and we've talked about it. The next category is influence. And I'd say, you know, there's influence on funk and soul and R&B and pop. And then the massive influence on hip hop cannot be understated. Last I checked whosampled.com, it lists them as 1,988 samples, which puts them in the top, like, you know, only James Brown and a few others and other hip hop artists on that list, or some obscure artist who has like a drum record that everybody like got into. But it's they are just up there among I mean, it's just across genres. I think they're a really important and influential group.
And again, I think the whole band thing, the 70s band thing, the funk band thing is it's a weak spot for the Hall. There's a number of folks that we could do this again for the Ohio Players, who have almost as much of a sort of the significance, if not the chart listings of Kool and the Gang. You know, same with the Barquets, same with and again, War, I think, is just some weird thing is going on with that. And there's a bunch of other bands. I just think the rock is allergic to bands,
oddly enough.
No, I mean, they're allergic to some types of bands.
Certain type of band, yeah.
To be clear, they love a certain type of band, and they kind of don't have as much space for others. But I mean, this would kind of definitely cause some opening, you know, widening of the lane for that, for other bands that are, you know, that have been overlooked as well.
Yeah, and the overlooking is a different thing now, because when I was collecting, you couldn't find the early records and you'd never hear the early record, and nobody could access the early records, and so you didn't really get a sense of their of somebody's path to rise or an mm-hmm. early phase and this and that. Now it's all there. And so you have folks, you know, 15 years old, Kool and the Gang, and they're just as accessible to the first album as they are to Misled or some of their later. It's all at once. And that's actually good and bad, because they don't necessarily know how the group evolved and kind of took, you know, was a leader in so many different phases of the music, if it is all a blur to them. But it is all accessible to them.
Yeah, we've kind of covered this already, the category of artistry slash skill. I mean, like we've said again and again, these are great musicians. They come out of jazz. They have a real ear for melody, though, as well, and hooks. It's why their music is still known today. And I found a quote. I don't know if you heard this before, but James Brown, who we've talked about a lot, said Kool and the Gang were the second baddest band around.
Second baddest out there after me.
That's yeah. some classic, you know,
right?
Brown.
You know, and
you need to know.
He's, you know, and praise from James Brown. And also another one that I thought was interesting, just in terms of the love for Kool and the Gang. There's a live performance of Prince and his band in Inglewood doing Inglewood Swingin'. Their take on Hollywood Swingin'. And you just think, like, if Prince is going to cover you, you must be the real deal.
Yeah.
And I hadn't seen that before. Last category, potentially the most important category, and a good one for them. Does my mom know who they are? And absolutely, she does. That's the thing. And it's like, as we talk about, like, getting to open the door to more funk, like, this is an accessible group that everybody knows, not controversial, not obscure. Their music continues to be ubiquitous. And I think the name still holds some weight as well.
Yes.
I keep thinking about this, because, like I said, the original members have been passing away. Mm-hmm. And the only original left is Cool.
Yes.
But he could walk on stage and you have Kool and the Gang.
The Gang is, yeah, there's no name specificity in the name itself. So is whatever gang
could be
Kool
anybody.
Has,
a lot of
yeah, it counts.
Whoever's on the stage, they're the Gang.
Yeah.
All right. Well, let's do the verdict. Let's get down to it. Should Kool and the Gang get in? Will they get in, and will it be this year? And Kristen, we'll start with you.
Well, if I had been doing this show with you for 5 years and I said that they should not get in, I don't know that our show would continue. Of course, yes, Kool and the Gang should get in. Will they get in? I mean, I think they will get in eventually. I do think, I mean, I think in some way, like, your campaign has really helped, especially just kind of like among the insiders, you know, it has moved the needle a bit. I hope that it moves it enough. I think we could really have a spinners on our hands this year, which was something I did not expect last year. And I think that there are enough, the voting body is still comprised of enough people who know and like and understand what, like, Kool and the Gang means. So I think they could get in this year. I hope they do.
Okay. Ricky, what do you think? Obviously, you think they should. Do you think they'll get in this year?
If this is the same entity that elected Gil Scott-Heron in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, now was late, was posthumous.
And that was also a special
side category. They put him right in.
So this is the larger voting body, which isn't quite as informed, but
that takes a little bit of the heat out of the flame there. But it's just, I don't know how many boxes you have to check off to be recognized. And you know, this happened early on in the sort of the growth of the rock hall. It's like, well, how do we account for the fact that people make music that is beyond Chuck Berry music? How do we do that? You know, how do we recognize that? And so they've been, so that's been a push and pull all this time. And I just think Kool and the Gang fills in all the boxes, and not just the categories you mentioned, but folks I think are recognizing, well, what is the weak spot? What is the sort of, you know, the uncharted ground in terms of the iconic music history that isn't well covered?
Mm-hmm.
That would be what Kool and the Gang provided in the 70s. My question is like, well, what if they didn't have that run in the 80s and they just had the 70s and maybe one or two pops?
Yeah.
You know, they people would still love them. Those shows would still be packed like they are now. But, you know, what it, so what, to me, it's like, what else does it take? So I think they'll go in just in terms of the timing, and that might open the door for more bands, like you say, like the Meters and War and then Ohio Players, and people will start to engage in that hunt a little bit more and look at these groups that influenced everybody. I'm a big fan of Charles Wright and the Watts 103rd Street Rhythm Band. They were very influential, but they were West Coast. They're not a part of the Southern or the New York Eastern or the Detroit thing. But everybody knows them. Everybody knows Express Yourself. Mm. And they had been around for years before that and years after that. And then the band left them and went and they were Bill Withers' band. When Bill Withers did the live album, that was all Charles Wright's band. Anyway.
we'll get to my verdict, which obviously I think they should. I think they will. I think it's going to be close this year. But like you said, Kristen, if the Spinners could sneak on last year, I think they're even in a better position than them. Because you think about the different parts of the voting body that Kool & the Gang appeals to. They've got the 70s crowd. They've also got the 80s crowd. Mm-hmm. They've got the R&B wing of the voters. They've got the hip-hop wing of the voters. There's a lot
and
of
they different... have a wide open lane.
Yes, yes. They're not competing. It's not like they're on this ballot against the Meters or, you know, probably. War.
Mm-hmm.
They have a lot of hits. And, you know, I would have loved it if they could have gotten in when we had back in maybe 2019 when we had Ronald Bell and DT and Funky George still with us. But the fact that they're not with us might on a sentimental level really drive the point home to these voters that like we got to get them in now. We've still got Cool. We still got JT. Let's do this. I really hope it's this year. I think I'm going to say they do squeak on, maybe at the expense of some of these newer acts that we think have a good shot. But there's going to be people who are going to say, like, how can you even consider Lenny Kravitz when we're talking about a band from the 70s?
And I would be with them.
Yeah. And so, but let's pretend like they're getting in. Let's talk about what this induction could look like and who could give the speech to induct. Now, this would be like a big marquee name for the hall. And I've been thinking about this and I've been like, you know, this is interesting. Who makes funk music now that could give the speech? And my mind went to Bruno Mars.
Oh,
that's where I was circling around that just as you were talking. I was like, well, who is legit? Who can speak to the now and the then type of thing?
Mm-hmm. Who makes new funk music?
Right. Exactly. You know? That's popular hits the charts. And I don't know if he has any love for Kool & the Gang. I haven't found anything that he's ever said. Now, interestingly enough, his Uptown Funk collaborator, Mark Ronson, has cited them as a massive influence, wrote a great piece in Rolling Stone about them after Ronald Bell died. But Mark Ronson's not given the speech because he's in full Foreigner mode because his stepfather, Mick Jones, is in Foreigner, and Mark has been very publicly pushing them. So like someone who could have done it likely to be in someone else's corner. Now we could go the hip hop lane. I mean, Questlove is always available. He's deep within the hall's ranks, and he has publicly given them love before, mm-hmm. for sure.
One of the Beastie Boys.
Sure. You could get Ad Rock
or Mike D.
Ice Cube, you know, sampled Summer Madness. He's also apparently covered Jungle Boogie Live.
What about Will Smith? You get Will Smith on his apology tour.
We might not be ready for Will yet. But hey, what about Nile Rodgers, who cited them as an influence? They've toured together now, Nile and Chic and Kool & the Gang. And they're even doing some tour dates together this summer. So, you know, that could be, and Niall's another person who's well connected within the hall and people love him. You know who surprisingly wanted them to open for their band in 2012? Van Halen. And it was David Lee Roth specifically who was like, I think we should have Kool & the Gang open for us. And it was a cool mixture of, you know, rock and funk that apparently went over quite well. And then
that sounds good.
Yeah, some outside the box choices. I saw singing with them on stage this year was Chris Tucker. Just hopped up and seemed to be having a good time. Sometimes they get actors and comedians to give a speech. They certainly know how to talk. Mm-hmm. And then the outside choice as well, Quentin Tarantino.
Oh, yeah. I mean, you know, it's the Cleveland question as well, though. Like, I don't know if you're going to get Tarantino to Cleveland to talk about Cool and the Gang, but I don't know. Maybe, who knows?
I like the Nile Rodgers idea because he's a New Yorker, and there is something about that New York. There's a New York thing, a 70s New York thing, a funk New York thing, a disco New York thing, and then all the clubby 80s New York thing that Nile was a part of. I keep thinking of David Bowie's Let's Dance. And so he was a contemporary of Kool & the Gang across that whole arc. So I would like to see that. And I think that reflects the stature of the band.
Totally. I mean, he can talk about how that bass line birthed Good Times, which then, you know.
The only thing is he's not got a lot of clout at the hall just thinking about how long it took him to be inducted.
Sure.
I mean, personally, I think it would be cool and neat, but I think sometimes they're like going with the biggest name they can get to, like,
who's contemporary and who's like gets the kids to watch. Yeah. I want to briefly touch on the fact that, you know, you've got those seven original members and you've got JT as who the Hall has listed as the inductees. And I wanted to shout out a few members who weren't from the original group, but I think potentially could be considered. There's a guy named Michael Ray, who's a trumpet player. He played with Sun Ra at one point, but he first appeared on Something Special from 1981 that has Get Down on it. And he's on nearly every record since then, and that includes some big ones. And he's still in the band and he plays with them live, as far as I can tell. And so potentially he is somebody that I think maybe they should consider. I guess that's kind of up to the band. But this guy just seems like he has been a part of it for 40 plus years. There's also a guy named Curtis Fitzwilliams, whose first appearance is on their 1982 album As One, doing keyboards and alto sax. He's got a songwriting credit on Joanna, Fresh, Cherish, and all their hits after that. And he's another one who's still with them and plays with them. I think he's one of the musical directors of the band at this point. I think it would be not, I'm just thinking about how there are guys who are still with us, who've been with this band for a while. They may not have been original members, but, you know, check with the band, whoever's listening, and can make those decisions. There's also a guy named
Cliff. Sometimes it changes, you know.
Yes,
once
it does.
They, you know, so that has happened before. It's possible. So
there's a guy named Clifford Adams. He isn't with us anymore. He was with the band, though, from as early as Ladies' Night in 79, has some songwriting credits, and was in the band in some capacity until his death in 2015. So I just wanted to, on the record, say that there's three additional guys. They're not the OGs, but I think they still were kind of important to the band at different stages.
See, that gets into a tricky thing, and maybe it's a band element to it, but any group that has multiple members, obviously you give deference to the founding members, but then at what point do you say, you're just a sustaining member, which gives you a different qualification than a founding member. I did an interview with this guy, Lige Curry. He's a bass player for George Clinton. He's been there since 1977, but he replaced Boogie Mason and Bootsy. And so 43 years, but he was the third bass player, and then he gave two awards out to two bass players already. So what do you say? Thank for your service.
Right. It's a tricky calculation to make. You know, I think if the band itself pushes for it, they can do that. We've seen that in the past, but
we have the old Reeves Gabrel, but yeah. Also, you know, there's no actual hall. It's not too crowded. You could just literally put anyone in. It doesn't
exist.
Why
not? Why not be generous? You know, but kind of the final question here, you know, I believe Kool & the Gang would play if inducted. I would love it if JT played with them. I don't know. I think there was some legal battles. I don't think it was a very, kind split. I think it was a little acrimonious. I know they reunited in 2018 for the Songwriters Hall of Fame. And I did find I found a live performance of JT from kind of recently, and he sounded great. I was really surprised because I don't think he's out there that much, but his voice was still intact. And so I would love it if they could, you know, mend that fence and get JT and Cool playing together with the touring version of the band, if there is a three song set, this is what I would think they would do. And I'm curious what you guys think. I think they open with the fanfare of Hollywood Swingin', but then Sneak Attack, it goes in the Jungle Boogie. And then they do Ladies Night and they do Celebration. And so they kind of get four in their medley style.
I like it. Medley style. And also that kind of those songs all flow together quite nicely. It would just be a blast. It would be very, very fun for that all to get. Just to see those.
It feels like ending on Celebration. Just that's kind of the move. But
really good times, come on. Yeah, and watching JT do it, and you know, I think people understand you move on, but then once in a while you have a gathering and you check in. I think that's fine. I wish that was how people approached it, and they didn't say, well, these bands aren't together so we can't award them. Well, you know, maybe a Lifetime Achievement Award would bring them together.
That often happens. We've seen that happen before. It can be very cool. We've also seen it where they just can't get their shit together and then people don't show up because of old beef. And it stinks. But, you know, when you can see a reunion, that's one of the most powerful things that the Hall can pull off. And so I hope that happens for Cool and the Gang. And Ricky, we can't thank you enough for going on a deep dive with these guys. You know, I'll be honest, there are not, it's hard to find, people who have talked about Cool and the Gang. You look for, there's no biography of them. You know, the band members have done their own memoirs, but you know, to get the guy who's written the book on funk, it really, It made for this whole thing worth it. And so I appreciate your time and your insight. And if there's anything you'd like to plug, any of your books or what have you, please, now's your time.
Oh, boy, I forgot all about that. RickyVincent.com. That's the starting point. So I got a few books. I have my own CD, which is kind of, I took a lot of interviews and mashed them into funky beats with the breaks from James Brown and Junie Morrison and people like that. Fool for the Funk is the name of my record. See if I can find it and show it off to y'all real quick. But I'm on the radio every Friday night on KPFA in the Bay Area. The History of Funk. That's the name of the show. KPFA. Ooh. You can look that up.
Nice.
And so I'm not hard to find. I'm glad you found me.
Yes.
And thank you to Daphne Brooks, who is the one to really make this connection happen. And so can't thank her enough.
Yeah, Daphne is a treasure.
She's the best. Hi, Daphne. If you're listening, we love you.
Thank you again. and thank you, Ricky. We really appreciate it. And to our listeners, they know they can follow us at Rock Hall Pod on Twitter and Instagram. RockHallPod@gmail.com is the email if you want to reach out. We have a Patreon, patreon.com/RockHallPod. If you want to hear us talk to real Rock Hall voters about their ballots, we got a tally going. So head on over there, see what we're doing. And thank you to Mike Lloyd for the logo, Yusuf Kim for the music, and Pantheon Podcast for hosting us. I'm Joe Quazala.
I'm Kristen Studdard.
And who cares
about the Rock Hall?
It's NFL draft season, and that means it's time to start thinking about fantasy football. FantasyPoints.com features industry-leading experts and prognosticators using proprietary hand-charted data to help you score more fantasy points. FantasyPoints.com is the place to go for whatever kind of fantasy football you play. Whether you play fantasy football, daily fantasy sports, or do a little bit of everything, Fantasy Points has the meticulously researched content to guide you to victory. And why wait for the fall? Fantasy Points also covers the new spring football league, the UFL. Join the guru, John Hansen, Scott Barrett, Joe Dolan, and other massive names in the fantasy football universe with an exclusive offer. Use code Pantheon for 15% off any Fantasy Points package, including the all-in package, with access to every article, tool, and data nugget that Fantasy Points has to offer. That's FantasyPoints.com and code Pantheon for 15% off at Fantasy Points. FantasyPoints.com, code Pantheon. Score more fantasy points.